and please the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
This is KOOP Hornsby, Austin. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. We're going to talk some politics. We're going to talk about the resistible rise of Donald J. Trump with a deep bow to Bertolt Brecht. But first, in a year that when we've lost David Bowie and Prince, which Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize, we have just lost another great poet. The headlines I love: Leonard Cohen, master of erotic despair, takes his leave. Great holy sinner, the poet laureate of longing. He inspired an awful lot of... Leonard Cohen, epic and enigmatic songwriter, is dead at 82. This is New York Times. Leonard Cohen, the Canadian poet and novelist who abandoned a promising literary career to become one of the foremost songwriters of the contemporary era, has died at his home in Los Angeles. He was 82. Over a musical career that spanned nearly five decades, Cohen wrote songs that addressed in spare language that could be both oblique and telling themes of love and faith, despair and exaltation, solitude and connection, war and politics. If there's anyone out there who should be under consideration by the Nobel Committee, I would think it would be Leonard Cohen. We will miss him greatly. All right, my guest today, like I said, we're talking about the resistible. Because I had no idea how to sum up what we're going to talk about here, so I just had to come up with something. The resistible rise of Donald J. Trump. My guests for this postmortem analysis of the 2016 presidential election and the ascendance of Donald Trump are Jonathan Tyelove and Glenn W. Smith. We'll discuss the unprecedented rise of Trump and Trumpism and how progressives can respond to the, shall we say, challenging development. Jonathan Tyelove is chief political writer at the Austin American Statesman. He was a Washington correspondent for the New Orleans Times-Picayune from 2008 to 2012, and before that covered race and immigration issues for Newhouse News Service for 18 years. John, a prominent Democratic consultant and Rag Radio political analyst, Glenn Smith, is an op-ed columnist for the Austin American Statesman and a former political reporter for the Houston Chronicle and the Houston Post. Smith, director of Progress Texas PAC, managed Ann Richards' winning 1990 Texas gubernatorial campaign. I'm one of those people who was just totally dumbfounded and so by the election of Donald Trump, and so overwhelmed, and I know there are a lot of other people who took it much worse, and I was no big Hillary Clinton fan, that I was so overwhelmed by what had happened that I just couldn't deal with it. I didn't want to read anything. I didn't want to watch, you know, I'm a sort of cable news junkie, and I just couldn't watch it, you know, and it kind of really came home when suddenly he was there meeting with Obama and sort of the realization that actually this guy is president and he's starting to do things that presidents do. And we should also note that immediately he started tweeting and there have been really big demonstrations all over the country. And first he said, oh, they're all media incited. This is president-elect Trump. He said they're media excited. And then he said, they're totally unfair. You know, as we look at things through Donald Trump's prism. But then he kind of came back, and today he said, I think that they are, he said something positive. I don't remember exactly what he said, because he's used to reversing course on a dime. I wrote down a list of, there's probably 50 things, all of which I thought were critical to talk about. We obviously aren't going to do that. So we're going to talk about what we talk about, and especially what Jonathan and Glenn want to talk about. This will not be the last time we discuss what's happening in the country. We'll start with Jonathan. Just give us your sense of what's happened.
Well, first, it's great to be here. Thanks very much.
Well, it's an honor for us to have you.
First, when you said you were dumbfounded, I think Donald Trump was dumbfounded by the outcome. I really don't think that he expected this to happen. I don't think his people expected this to happen. So I think it was startling to him. And I think more than any other human being in the United States, Donald Trump did everything he could in his power to discredit Donald Trump and to tell you not to vote for him. So this is not on him. This is on everybody else. The reason I think he won is because he represented change in a year, if you sort of look historically, should have been a change election, because you had 8 years of Obama, and it's rare that you get a third term for a party. And this is Hillary Clinton, and it felt not like a third term, it felt like a fifth term of Clinton plus Obama. And I think that she was kind of encrusted by everything that represents the status quo. And so he's saying, make America great again. People are saying, well, that's terrible, that's racist, America's already great. But you can't run from the left saying America's great and everything's okay. And I think that he captured, people said, I don't care what else he represents. I think a lot of people didn't think he'd get elected. He was gonna, you know, take Washington by the heels and shake it. And I think that I can't think of a time when a president took office so unbeholden to anybody, because he's as much been the enemy of the Republican Party as the Democratic Party. So I think it's, you know, I do think every time you look at this scene now, you kind of, you know, you have to rub your eyes and go, is this really happening? But it really is happening, and I think it's unprecedented, and I think it's, you know, this was a close election when it came right down to it. It could have gone the other way for dozens of reasons.
Well, of course, it did in the popular vote.
It did in the popular vote, which, you know, I think it was Trump who tweeted last time that there people should be out in the streets protesting if Romney was denied the presidency because he didn't win the electoral if he won the popular. But he's flexible. And, you know, you're right. His tweet this morning, yeah. I don't know whether this was him or whether someone intervened, but it said, it's nice to see small groups of people showing their love of country by protesting.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's admirable sentiment. Okay. Glenn Smith.
Well, I agree with a lot of that. I want to add a couple of things to it. First of all, I think we should be careful in discussing what part of America just elected Trump. Only about half of America's eligible voters voted, and only about just slightly more than half of them, not even half of them, voted for Trump. So he was just elected by a minority of the eligible voters in Texas, so we need to be aware that. There's a reason I want to say that, though, is during the course of the campaign, as Jonathan said, Trump did everything he could to alienate people and tell us not to vote for him. But as a part of that, he launched vitriolic, violent, bullying attacks on a lot of different kinds of people, from African Americans to Latinos to gay lesbians to veterans to women. Judging by the phone calls I've had over the last 48 hours, most of them, those kinds of people sobbing and scared out of their wits, law-abiding Latinos, here with papers, so to speak, are scared about their neighbors and others being hauled away in the dark of the night. And this is America. We have to take that fear seriously. Now, in their minds, they look at American voters deciding that Trump was right about them. You know, they don't notice that there may have been other reasons people voted for Trump. In their minds, it was his attacks on them that led people to vote for Trump, because they liked to see Trump beating them and theirs up. I think we have to honor that. And I think, as for those who voted for other reasons for Trump, I have an idea, I don't know this for certain. I think there's a phenomenon now that's sort of like the American Idol or Celebrity Apprentice. I think Trump had voters without a clue about the consequences or potential consequences. I think, like Jonathan said, they wanted change. They overlooked all of Trump's many flaws and obvious bigoted downsides. Said, oh, heck, he's going to be new and different. And by the way, in my life, nothing ever really changes in Washington. So what could go wrong? And they cast their votes. And I think they're about to see what could go wrong because I think it's devastating.
Well, I was just going to say, from the time he got into the race, when, you know, I, with everyone else, didn't take him seriously, I thought it was useful to think of him in terms of professional wrestling, because he is a member of the WWE Hall of Fame. He has been in the ring with Vince McMahon, shaving his head. And the thing is, it's Kerferb, I think it's called, where it's this winking sense that we're all going to pretend this is real, but it's not. And I think he was absolutely a Kerferb candidate for president. And I think I went to Trump rallies, and I did not find those people to be menacing. And I found that they understood that he was a caricature. He was a cartoon of their candidate. That wasn't what they were really going to get. And I think they're hoping that's not what they're really going to get.
Well, that may have been your experience, but I also know people who went to Trump rallies other places or who were around mm-hmm. Trump rallies, and we've also seen them on television, and there was a lot of very menacing stuff that happened, and part of it was the way he inspired the white nationalist, even neo-Nazi movement in this country, and we should also look at the fact that his election is part of a trend that's happening in the Western world with far, far right-wing nationalist, anti-immigrant, and even racist people coming into power in other places. So I just have to ask, and for whatever reasons we think the election happened, and for whatever reasons the people who did vote, and that's a, it says something about the American populace, but what does it say that for whatever reasons, because they wanted change, because they were upset with the status quo, because they didn't think he would actually, you know, do maybe the things he said, because they didn't believe it, because they just thought he was. What does it mean that we would elect somebody who has openly, consistently been a far right bigot, has derided women, has, you know, wanted to not allow Muslims to come into the country, who's been racist, xenophobic, and who's inspired the Klan and other white nationalist groups, not only just to support him, but to mobilize in a way that they hadn't mobilized in a long time. It's like he's touched this dark thing in the American consciousness.
Let me take that, because I want to play off of something Jonathan said, because that's very fascinating observation to me, and I think there's something to it, that it was a performance art thing that Trump was doing. But to me, that's even more despicable and irresponsible. It's like shouting fire in a movie theater, but saying to save yourself, shoot the person of color before you go, right? I mean, it was really, really awful. But I think Jonathan has a point that if he was performing, and to him it was like professional wrestling. And we ought to hope that he wants to perform a different play now, right? We can hope that, but I don't know if he's got it in him. And I think he may have launched America on a trajectory that he doesn't even know he launched it on.
Well, this may be your competition, but if you were listening to Alex Jones election night, Alex Jones had Roger Stone in the studio for the entire night. Alex Jones could not believe what was happening, because he was finding out. He said the election was going to be rigged, it was going to be stolen.
It
may have been, but the point is,
in the other direction,
he was giddy, but he was also saying, I got, you know, my gut tells me this. He says, my spidey sense is on a high tingle, because he thought that Soros Wednesday morning would step in and undo the result. Now, the thing is that Alex Jones is sort of the mind meld with Trump. The question is, is he going to be satisfied with Donald Trump in a year, or is Donald Trump going to be part of the global conspiracy? And I think does he leave those people behind? Or I think Trump had no scruples about taking advantage of every racist, misogynist impulse Americans have. I don't know whether there's something in him that then rises to the occasion. I have no idea. I mean, there's not a lot of evidence of it, but at the same time, you got to hope.
Well, of course, he didn't just play on those kind of sentiments and as theater. He also has a long history,
right.
Various forms of racism and bigotry,
right.
And certainly misogyny. So it's the question is, who is the real Trump? Is there a real Trump? You know, and is he going to, what is going to happen? What is he going to do? You know, is he going to somehow transform into something different? Is a real Trump, is there something underneath there that's actually real that's going to suddenly emerge?
Before I even go further talking about that, I've got to respond to all the dozens of calls and people who have come to see me. As I wrote in a column that will appear today, in the feelings of these people, it's very similar to me, the feelings after the King and Bobby Kennedy assassinations, where I was old enough to understand what had happened and how people were. There's this hollow emptiness, this shock. After those, however, America had the good sense to reject George Wallace. Now America has kind of elected a guy that presented himself as the very ghost of George Wallace, and that scares me. But before we figure out how to overcome that hatred, or whatever may be intended by the president-elect, I think we better spend some time talking to one another and kind of helping one another, because I think the despair and the hurt is very deep from women who suffered abuse earlier in their lives, who have suffered through a campaign where it was treated cavalierly and something men could sport talk about in public. I think we better give them some attention, because to not do that would be irresponsible. And I think we need to build them into the ultimate solution to the resistance that you spoke of at the top.
Okay. I think, Tracy, maybe this would be a good time for us to take a quick break, because we're sort of at an end point. We take two breaks during the show, guys. We're talking with Jonathan Tylove, who's the chief political writer for the Austin American Statesman, and Glenn Smith, who is a renowned political consultant and journalist and ragblog political analyst. Tracy. Tracy?
Yeah, a little bit, some new music from Leonard Cohen. His album, You Want It Darker, just came out
October. New national anthem.
Yes.
Really?
It came out on October 21st, and he has a line in there, so he's talking about God, and he did an interview shortly after saying that he was ready to pass on, and then he passed on.
And he passed on.
So. Yeah.
And as I said before, it's a great loss, because he was a dark but magical poet, I think, yeah. And performer. Okay, we're talking about the presidential election, something that's not really easy to do at this point, and something about which we don't yet have all that much perspective, although there's lots of things about it to talk about. My guests are Austin American Statesman chief political writer Jonathan Tylove and Democratic consultant and Rag Radio political analyst Glenn W. Smith, who's also director of Progress Texas PAC. I was looking at this morning, and we can continue with the discussion we were already having because it's fascinating. But I was looking at just some of the headlines that were out there, and it's not anything comprehensive; it's just spotty. But The one, the New York Times is saying, it came out with an, had an editorial saying, we need to do some soul searching, that the media needs to address the way it handled the whole affair, and I think that's important. The Daily Beast said that New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has said that he will resist much of what Donald Trump wants to do, and that you know, he said that that if Trump follows through on his campaign promises to deport undocumented immigrants, restrict abortion, and expand stop and frisk, he said that the city will fight him. We're not going to take anything lying down. I think that's the central point. Anything we see as a threat to New Yorkers, we're going to confront. Here's another. 75 lawsuits against President-elect Trump. How much is that going to happen? You know, everybody, he said, oh, there's going to be these investigations. Hillary Clinton is going to, all this stuff is going to come out. But there's a whole lot out there about him, really more than there was about Trump, that I assume the media will, and I think the media have said that they're going to follow up on and keep pushing him on. So that's another thing. There's just so many things. Team Trump, as Trump transitions to power, Cabinet of Horrors starts taking shape, okay? And then, on the other hand, Team Trump struggling to fill national security jobs. And then the real Trump effect, down ballot disaster for Democrats. Gentlemen, where do we go from here? I mean,
strategically, those of us opposed to Trump and all he stands for and the Republicans who have lined up behind him, I think we've got to spend some time charting a way forward. I think we have to oppose him on just about everything he tries to do, in similar ways to the Republican opposition to everything Obama tried to do. I don't think we give him any rein to run away with the country and with its democracy. There's some things, like if he wants to invest $1 trillion in rebuilding America's infrastructure, I'd be for it. I don't think he can get it by the Republicans in Congress, but I'll sure support that. Other than that, we need to oppose him in every possible way we can, and in every front, from local governments to state governments to the federal government, in all kinds of ways, from street protests to legislative log jams to attacking his own allies where we can and keeping them distracted and disrupted. I mean, I think it's that serious.
Assuming we survive the next 4 years, if you're a Texas Democrat, you're much better off with Donald Trump as president than Hillary Clinton, not in terms of what happens to the country or policy, but politically. If Hillary Clinton were president, it was going to be a dismal couple of years for Texas Democrats. It was going to be, they were just going to be running against her the way they ran against Obama, and it was going to be hard to resist. You now get a chance to kind of, it's kind of like you clear the underbrush and you can sort of, you can start over. I mean, she was a voice from the past, and you can really now, I think Democrats now run people statewide regardless, because as an act of resistance against Trump, even if there's not a chance they're going to win, whereas I think otherwise there was going to be calculations about, well, do we actually run a candidate for governor, or is if we don't do as well, is that going to be seen as a setback? I think it energizes Democrats in a way that I think a Hillary Clinton presidency wouldn't have.
Let me add something that's interesting. I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. I hope they don't pass so many voter suppression laws over the next 2 years that we can't come back if we want to, right?
Yeah, and when is redistricting?
It'll come after.
It'll be after the midterm.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. But interesting to note that of all the states, Hillary received more votes than Obama in only four. Texas headed that list, with a 2.2% growth in Democratic preference voting for the presidential candidate from the Democratic Party. We were the top gain in the country. All of our urban areas, even Austin, where you didn't know, Travis County, where you didn't know we had this room to grow, our totals were 7% higher than 2012. And so I think we're prepared now to mount seriously strong campaigns in 2 years. And I think it's right that Jonathan says, as unfortunate as it is, as scared as I am for the fate of the country today, it's going to be a little bit easier to run in 2 years against Trump than it would have been to run trying to defend and support Hillary Clinton.
He's a big orange-haired target.
Right.
I mean, and I would think that's not just in Texas.
No, that's everywhere. It's just that the anomalous situation, which as Glenn said, was that Texas moved in the opposite direction. Texas became closer. Yeah. even as he was winning nationally in the Rust Belt. So it was a kind of realignment, but I think that's a lot to do with the demographics and the state of the economy. But the point is that that Texas Democrats should be less I mean, if you're a Michigan Democrat, you got to be going like, you know, what happened here?
Yeah. Well, and the fact that he's almost certain, partly because he gave he came up with all these promises, these incredible promises, which are things that the president can't do,
right,
or that are just totally dysfunctional or impossible, like the border wall, that he's not going to be able to come through on most of that stuff. He'll come through on maybe working with Ryan and whatever on some, you know, some of the kind of right wing Republican stuff that they've been trying to get for a long time. The other headline that I left out was about Paul Ryan, who said on Fox News last night, he just announced that as part of repealing Obamacare, he plans to phase out Medicare and replace it with private insurance for retirees.
Yeah, but Trump's not with that.
Yeah, that's my point.
Trump's Mr. Benefits.
Yeah. So
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he might just fall into the Republican. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what he's going to be.
I think that's the beauty of Trump, is that I don't think he cares about what they think.
Yeah. Well, unless somehow, once he now realizes that this is real, that he doesn't know what he's doing, and he's totally out of his element, maybe
I think he does have a gift for knowing what that audience that he talked to wants. And I don't think what was absolutely clear was that those people in the Midwest and the Rust Belt and elsewhere, they want their benefits. They want their Medicare, they want their Social Security. They do not want that stuff scaled back. They may be jealous or angry that other people get it as well, or that they may think welfare is not legitimate, but Social Security is. But they don't want to see anything touched that they get in their check every month.
Right. No, they don't. There's an interesting dynamic here on both what they may try to do with Medicaid and Medicare and with the Affordable Care Act, all right? Strategically, those senators that are up in 2 years, Republican senators are up in 2 years, will not want any of that to be effective before 18.
Right.
They'll want it. They may vote to repeal Obamacare, but that won't be effective till 19. But from Trump's perspective and those that are up for 20, they won't want it to happen after 18. So they'll be in this strategic impasse a bit. Okay, this sounds good, but who's going to get beat? Because let me tell you the numbers. Leaving Medicare aside for a minute, people underestimate the impact of the Affordable Care Act repeal. It's not 20 million people. It's people like my wife, right, who has a pre-existing condition but has to buy an individual policy. The numbers are closer to 35 or 40 million Americans you'd knock out of health insurance. Now, who wants to run for public office after doing that anywhere? Right? Very few. Only the meanest of the mean.
And that's the thing that people are sort of acknowledging, that will be the first thing they do. But I don't see how you can do it. For one thing, they don't have any kind of plan to replace it. That makes any sense.
If you're a Texas Democrat looking for comfort, just think about, would you rather have Ted Cruz being inaugurated? And I don't think you would.
No.
I don't think you would. I think with Trump, you don't know what's going to happen. With Cruz, you know exactly what's going to happen. I don't think Cruz would have been elected because he couldn't make the breakthroughs that Trump did in those states. But
in terms of pragmatic politics.
Right. I think what unites Texas Democrats with Mitt Romney and the Bushes is just offense at the guy as a human being, just this abhorrence of him as being just the contemptible guy. It's not the policy so much as it is just, you know, this guy's president. It's the sense that he violated the sense of decorum and, you know, decency.
Do you think a lot of those people who are willing to accept that in the campaign will have problems with it once he's president? I mean, I'm looking at whether there's going to be backlash from the people who elected him and how much. You know, that's...
Well, yeah.
You know, there are some people who just didn't care, who just wanted someone up there to throw, you know, wrenches into the machinery, monkey wrench type, you know, stuff. And, you know, I don't know that he even has the skills to do that. But do you understand what I'm saying? Are we looking at a potential, you know, wave election?
Anything can happen.
Midterm?
It could be. It's possible. But let me tell you, anything can happen. Let's just look back to between 2000 and post 9/11 America. Before 9/11, George W. Bush's popularity was collapsing. He was seen as an inept, know-nothing, right? And then 9/11 happens, and the country doesn't have any choice but to rally behind the president at the time. He didn't even do a very good job, obviously. Then he got us into a war that's kind of half-destroyed the world, for heaven's sakes. But we had to rally behind him. The same thing could happen to a Trump before 2 years, right? I mean, we wouldn't have any choice but to support a commander-in-chief in the aftermath of a terrible tragedy. I'm just using an extreme right. example to say anything could happen. But looking at the status quo, if he's got to try to like just perform the normal duties of President of the United States between now and 2 years, I think we have potential of great gains in Texas. I think there will be a backlash. I don't think people are going to like him. I don't think his personality is going to change. And I think we are kind of better off as somebody to, as a pinata to run against yeah. than we would be with some of the other potential candidates.
What do you think is the likelihood that he actually will feel so will be so lost that a kind of Dick Cheney will emerge? You know, who will become the power behind the presidency? Do you think he's too much of an egomaniac to let that happen?
It would have to be somebody who was so skillful that Trump didn't even know that he was
Bob Bullock, you know,
that he was being manipulated. Yeah. That, you know, I mean, it does seem like Kellyanne Conway managed to whisper stuff into his ear in a way that got through. So I could see her being sort of quiet, but I don't see her as being the out front person.
One of the interesting things that I thought that no one has mentioned, but I actually thought this when I started watching the results, that Kellyanne Conway should be a superstar now. I mean, because she really did come in and I think play a remarkable role. I mean, I have no admiration for her, but that she, in terms of just the job that she did, I think she played a major role in turning that thing around.
I think she played a huge role.
She was the first person who could do anything.
She's also somebody who I think actually is in touch with sort of
reality.
Reality and how people think and sort of how you could possibly get a suburban woman to vote for Donald Trump.
Right. Well, they made real good decisions about places to go at the end, too.
Had a moment during after the Comey letter. She had a moment where Trump on the campaign trail said that Hillary was about to be indicted. And that story was retracted, in fact, totally and 100% within hours of it being reported. And she was on television. She said, "I don't care. We've done the damage. We got the word indictment out there." And once again, at some point, we could give people credit for, like, you know, tactical smarts. But my God, that is so morally depraved. I can't look at her any other way.
It was only tactical smarts that I was giving credit for. So I needed to remind people that we're talking to Glenn Smith and Jonathan Tylove. Jonathan Tylove of the Austin American Statesman, chief political writer, and Glenn Smith, who you've heard, if you're a regular listener to the Rag Radio, you know what he contributes and how important his contribution is in terms of talking politics on this radio station. So... what about, I don't know where to go next. Do you guys have, because I've got lots of things.
Just one observation. It seems to me that what's so jarring about this is that it follows Obama. And I think Obama was like ahead of schedule. So it's almost like this is out of historical sequence. It's supposed to be the last gasp of white America followed by the embrace of multicultural America. And instead, it's in reverse order. So this is sort of the reaction. The point, though, is that both, you know, in both cases, you're not talking about great numbers of people changing their votes. It's sort of divided down the middle, and one gets an advantage one time and one another. I don't think, partly because of the circumstance he arrived in, that Obama was as transformational a president as he was, but culturally, he was transformational. And I think, you know, especially if you grew up with him as your president and then you see Donald Trump, you go like, how can this be the same country?
Okay, so is Trump an anomaly or is this a redirecting of the political world?
I believe that depends on what happens to the institutions of democracy over this tenure, right? I mean, let's look at what they tried to do even before he was elected, just with voter ID and with gerrymandering and with the closing of ballot boxes in heavily minority areas and multiplying them in white areas. And, I mean, they could continue with that. He's going to appoint a Supreme Court justice, another topic we wanted to talk about in a minute. they could probably get away with that, put these barriers to actual popular democracy in place before the next election with a Supreme Court that'll say, okay. I mean, if that happens, what the hell do we do? And then I'm a little bit, you know, I don't know.
Okay, what do we look at going down? Certainly the Affordable Care Act, Roe v. Wade, you know, the EPA, I mean, environmental regulations, you know, but also, you know, is this going to be a threat to freedom of the press? Because he has such a, he's already not, he didn't let press go along, which is a longstanding tradition, which going to the White House and all the stuff he already did. And then he immediately blamed the press for the demonstrations that were happening. Is there a threat there?
Yeah, I actually have not the slightest idea how he deals with the press, because I think his entire operational mode is to go around the press. And again, you know, whether it's those alt-right people or Alex Jones, he's got his, or Drudge, that's how he communicates. He doesn't care, really. I mean, to the extent that you have headlines day after day in the Washington Post or the New York Times or any place else condemning him, that all helps. So I don't know, you know, he doesn't need to operate in the way that everybody else up until now has operated. And I don't know whether at some point he realizes, well, really, you know, you got to play this game.
Does that indicate his skills at going around the press and so forth, or does it, and ignoring the major news outlets, or does it say something about where people in this country are now getting their information and about the weakening role of centralized media outlets?
Well, I think both. I think it coincides with the decline of sort of the power of newspapers and the mainstream press, and the proliferation of, you know, news from every other source.
And conspiracy theories.
And so I do think the danger is that people become completely unconnected to reality in a far greater degree, and that they just operate on the basis of what Trump tells them. And so essentially the mainstream press is a 24/7 fact-checking operation, which the half of America that likes Trump ignores.
Not only ignores, but think it's part of the conspiracy. And that's right. One thing about conspiracy theories is that
they're self-fulfilling.
They're self-fulfilling. Yeah. They're circular logic. You can't.
Right. So that's pretty scary, at least for a reporter. It's scary.
I mentioned earlier, I mean, in this long list of topics I have here, one of the things is that I noted how many different things people have claimed were the deciding factor in this election. I even saw a claim that, and I mean, it's not, maybe it's legitimate, that Facebook especially, and social media, but especially Facebook, that it was the primary source of information for so many people, and there was some blatant lie that was referred to in this article, which, you know, they showed the number of people who went to fact check it, and then they showed the number of people who just shared it, and it was, you know, it was a very, very small percentage that seemed to care about whether it was factual or not.
Yeah, and but though, you know, Facebook, a lot of it is also just recycling stuff that's been in sort of more legitimate sources, but then not, and there's no,
well, not blaming Facebook per se.
No, I understand, but that's it's all, to me, scary.
It's the era of the meme.
And sometimes it doesn't even matter, for instance, like what's read, right, on Facebook or anywhere else. I was, you know, that new movie, Before the Flood, with Leonardo DiCaprio in his UN role as the climate guy. And you watch this, you see the movies of the water rising already into the streets of Miami on a regular basis, and then know that the governor of Florida won't let them use the term climate crisis or global warming in public. And the water is already in their houses. It's not something stupid they've read on Facebook or somewhere else. The water's there, and people are able to deny it when the governor says make it so. That's even more scary to me.
We've used George Orwell a lot over the years as to say, oh, well, this is Orwellian or whatever. But talking about language now, and that the way we ignore it, the way we change it, the way we...
It's bigly. You
know, it's bigly. Yeah. It's very bigly. Okay, we need to take another break. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My colleague, who I didn't introduce before, is Tracy Schultz. my compadre, and Roger Baker is here taking pictures. So the old reliable team. My guests again are Jonathan Tylove and Glenn Smith, and we're talking about Groan, Shudder, the presidential election.
The crops are all in and the peaches are rotting. The oranges are back in the creosote dumps. They're flying and back to the Mexico border. They trade all their money to wade back again. Still they lay down and die. Goodbye to my wife. Goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos. Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. All ever call you will be deportees.
Okay, that was Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. With the incredible Woody Guthrie song, Deportees. Seems appropriate, Tracy, don't you think?
Yeah, that might happen to all of us.
Yeah, really, that's what, I have to go, my passport has expired, and I'm going to the post office immediately to get one, to get the application, because I don't want to, I shouldn't even tell people that, maybe they'll put in a, put in an alert not to approve it. We're talking about the resistible rise of Donald J. Trump with Austin American statesman, chief political writer, Jonathan Tylove, and Democratic consultant and Rag Radio political analyst, Glenn W. Smith. Glenn W. Smith, in case you want to don't get it mixed up.
It stands for Wilson as in Pickett. That's what I like to say.
As opposed to Wilson as in Woodrow?
Pickett. I said Pickett. Wilson Pickett.
Oh, Pickett. Pickett. Never mind. So we've talked about a bunch of stuff, and there's a lot of things to talk about. Do we want to talk about the what's he likely able to do, and how do we respond to it?
Let's talk for a minute because it's fun to strategize. It's important to strategize about what we do with the court.
It's a survival thing, if nothing else.
He's going to get an appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court right off the bat because the Republicans refused to confirm a replacement for Scalia.
And they knew what they were doing.
It seems like they may have had an idea that they'd get an opportunity, right? But I think it's time now for the Democrats to do whatever they can to delay each and every judicial appointment for Trump as long as they possibly can. I actually think, as we talk about what his first term might be like, the more time that goes, the more weeks that go by, the more chance there's going to be that he really screws up. So whatever we can do to delay the consequences of Donald Trump in the White House accrue to the favor of democracy in America, right? So I hope that Senate Democrats, you know, if they keep the filibuster or not, do whatever can be done to delay the confirmation of any judicial appointments, including one to the Supreme Court.
What powers are there to delay?
They have the benefit of a lot of Republicans, including Ted Cruz, recently saying the court doesn't really need to fill that vacancy. That you don't. There's no set number for the court. You can live with eight, you can live with seven, live with six. So they were so certain that Trump was going to lose that they were preparing the argument for denying Clinton being able to name anybody. But they have sort of laid the groundwork. I think, you know, my guess is that Trump's court pick would be much more unpredictable if that wasn't what every conservative was going to hold his feet to the fire on.
I agree with you.
They've got a very limited set of people he can choose from. So I think the Democrats look at that and they go, okay, is this the best that we could expect from him, or is this the worst, or as bad as any? And then I think, yeah, I think Glenn's right. I think then they their strategy is to do what the Republicans would have done if Clinton were there, which is to deny him for as long as possible.
And there are certainly certain procedures, you know, within, you know, that you can do to stall things and stop things. But there are also procedures that the Republicans, with total power as they have now, can eliminate if they want to.
If they're going to do that, force them to do it, right?
Yeah.
So don't assume ahead of time that they will or won't do it. If they're going to suspend all the rules and all the laws and just sort of take absolute control without regard for the traditions, the principles, and the laws of democracy, we'll force them to do it, because that's a negative right. in itself.
But the flip side of that was that Harry Reid was prepared to steamroll or Republicans in the same way. So, I mean, again, it's less about philosophy than it is about politics and power.
Yeah, well, I guess, but I think we've turned a corner. I mean, I think we really do have a dramatically different situation right now, beyond just certainly beyond sectarian politics or beyond. What do we think he will do? What do we think he wants to do? What do we think he's going to have the power to do? I mean, it's, you know, there's certainly a lot of terrible things that could happen, but is he? We don't know who he is now. We don't know really what Donald Trump we're going to see. And we don't know if we'll see the same one from day to day, which is the, you know, his lack of an ability to concentrate, his lack of attention span. How's that going to affect him?
I have no idea. And I do think that he wants to do big things and be the builder. So I think he'd like to be, you know, FDR. He'd like to be LBJ. It runs totally counter to what Republicans like to think of as who their president's going to be. So I think there's an ultimate conflict there about being a big president with big government and being the president of a party that's supposed to dismantle government.
Do you see the possibility of his actually moving in that direction?
I don't think. I think he's going to gaze out across the mall at that giant tower of the Washington Monument and see a huge billboard for the word Trump. I don't think he can avoid, like, stamping the world with his ego and his name. The Lincoln Memorial better look out, you know, because it could become the Trump Memorial overnight if he has his way.
That speaks to what Jonathan said. I mean, you don't do that without having big government unless your name is up there because you dismantled it.
Yeah, but see, I don't think he's got the conceptual philosophy or anything. He's the Republican Party to him is just something he took over. And he said it's not called the Conservative Party. He said it's the Republican Party. So I just think that, you know, I mean, you know, the great hope of America is that he listens to Ivanka a lot.
Okay, let's look at what the Democrats do. Who's going to be the leadership? What role are Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren going to have? Because I've heard a number of commentators say that they think they're going to end up being extremely powerful.
Well, they're going to have to take big, prominent public roles, I think. And I think, obviously, Senator Schumer's in a position where he's going to be calling a lot of shots in the Senate, where a lot of this important action is going to take place. And the same with the minority leadership in the House. But I look to the Senate to be our primary sort of battle line, right? So Schumer's clearly very, very important. My own view is, and I think all Democrats should be communicating to the Democratic leadership and to their senators and congressmen, I think they got to resist Trump at every turn. And I think we need to tell them to resist Trump at every turn. And we need to tell them it's going to be hell to pay if they start the normal kind of patty cake with a new president so they can go along and get along. I don't think this is a time to do that. I think if they're doing it to bring a few crumbs home, pork home to their constituents is yesterday's way, right? I think the existence of democracy is on the line, and we need to make our representatives do what needs to be done.
Okay, here's a question, and obviously the dynamics would be totally different, but would Bernie Sanders have won? Would he have beaten Trump?
Well, Hillary Clinton didn't beat Trump, so we know that.
Yeah.
I think the question would have been whether a cranky old Jewish socialist, what he would have been victimized with, but he certainly, Trump couldn't have run as the change agent, as the sole change agent and the outsider, because you were not going to paint Bernie Sanders, the cranky Jewish socialist, as the status quo. So I think it would have been an entirely different election, and you know, at least right now, you could make the argument that he would have won, but that's all speculation.
Yeah, I mean, because he certainly, you know, a lot of people that I knew in the Democratic Party, people who supported Hillary when I was actually supporting Bernie Sanders, a lot of said, oh, because they're going to bring out all this stuff about his past. They're going to bring out all this stuff about his being a socialist. But nothing they would have brought out about Bernie Sanders would even touch what Donald Trump was able to just, you know,
right. It would have been, it would have.
So I always thought, and of course now, you know, the socialist, especially with younger people, is not a bad word.
What makes you think they would have to have something factual on Bernie, right? I mean, the emails aren't factual.
You're saying they would be better at smearing?
They could have smeared him with anything they wanted to make up.
The point is that whether it's a machine that went to attack her or the accumulation of her history, the point is you had 30 years of accumulated stuff about Clinton. And with Sanders, it's just, you know, he was mayor of Burlington and he was a kind of oddball guy, but he was who he was pretty much the same every step through.
What role do you think the press had in being an enabler for Trump?
Oh, you know, enabler,
I think my
view is, you know, first of all, I think we got to support the press. I think a lot of our hopes are going to rely on the job they do going forward. So I don't see much need in criticizing.
Well, I'm not saying criticizing, but they need to analyze.
I think you brought them a new world, right? I mean, I think certain ones made mistakes. I think Scarborough and them made a terrible mistake letting Trump call into the show every single morning instead of forcing him to come on the set where he could be grilled. I think Scarborough made himself part of the Trump effort when he did that. That kind of thing is terrible.
That's not.
Yeah, I don't. I think there was a codependence because of the kind of candidate Trump was. I mean, the point is, I did watch Trump rallies whenever they were on, and I would not have sat there and watched Clinton rallies. So, you know, if you had put them on, I might have watched some. But Trump was because you did not know where he was going or what ridiculous place he was going to end up, they were riveting. And so I guess you could say, don't feed that appetite. The problem was that the press did an enormous amount of coverage of all of his defects. And the problem is that for most of his or a lot of his constituency, none of that mattered. And the piling on only made him seem like the heroic individual against all the forces of punditry, the press,
an underdog of sorts.
But the criticism that has come from a lot of directions, including from inside the press, and I've heard it a lot, is that they dealt with him as a legitimate candidate from the very beginning, as opposed to a theatrical candidate.
You're screwed either way. The Huffington Post first said they're putting it on the entertainment page. Well, I thought that was stupid.
Oh yeah,
you know, but the problem is, you had some in the press saying, well, you got to treat him respectfully because he is there, especially when he became the Republican nominee. Then there's others saying, you know, the Times would have a list of, you know, 300 lies in, you know, Trump delivered, and they give you one after the other. So, you know, the Boston Globe early on had the front page of what would happen if he were elected president and the horrors that would ensue. I mean, the press clearly had a point of view.
That's a bigger issue. But I think you got to start there. See, I think Jonathan's right. A lot of those things, gaffes, negatives, outrageous, bigoted, terrible things he did and said got reported. And right now the question becomes, why did they make no difference? If you go back in time and think, a story that Al Gore said that he might have been one of the models for the male character in Love Story was such a negative that it played a role in beating him. Why could some of Trump's statements about the sexual assault of women not make a difference? That's not necessarily the media's fault.
No, and that's a whole subject. Right. That's a topic that's certainly important and we have to wonder about. But I just want to pursue this one a little bit further, because the mold was cast after the primaries. And it wasn't to do with whether, it wasn't to do with whether whether they published positive or negative things about Trump. It was just from the beginning, he was given so much exposure, dramatically more exposure than anybody else. And it has to do with the tendency to, just get audience, readers, to get viewers.
Yeah, it's to get audience, and it's also because it was so unusual.
1 minute. We have 1 minute, so
the hurricane gets more coverage than the thunderstorm, right? And Trump knows it. And, reporters, God bless them, but they love to cover hurricanes.
Yes, but hurricanes are significant things that threaten the people. You know,
he gave them
I don't think that analogy works. it's an interesting one. So, final words. 20 seconds.
I wrote something before saying any self-interested reporter should vote for Trump because he will be he will keep us employed.
I rest my case.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us. And maybe we'll do this again sometime, maybe after a while, and look back at what we've said and what has happened. Jonathan Tylove and Glenn Smith with us here talking about the resistible rise of Donald Trump. Next week, monumental sculptor and Texas cultural icon Bob Daddy-O Wade will be joining us here in the studio. And you can also go and to theragblog.com and you can find the podcast of our last show, which was Rabbi Arthur Waskow and Carl Davidson on the legacy of Tom Hayden. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.